I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania's prison population has increased dramatically in the last three decades from 7,000 inmates in 1980 to more than 50,000 today. In just the last decade alone, the number of prisoners in the state has increased 40%. This rise has come with a steep price, almost $2 billion spent on corrections in Pennsylvania. The question is the state getting its money's worth? Our guest, Pennsylvania Corrections Secretary John Wetzel, is part of a diverse panel that is calling for reforms, including reducing the inmate population, rethinking sentencing for some nonviolent offenders, and streamlining the parole process. And Secretary John Wetzel joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you here. Thank you for getting up so early in the morning.
Well, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Why so many people behind bars in Pennsylvania?
Well, a lot of it is policy-driven. At the same time the numbers went up, crime has not increased at the same slope. So that suggests that policy, that our population is at least in part policy driven. Some of that comes from inefficiencies within our system, how we process inmates in, how we deliver programs, because most inmates have to do programs before they get paroled. And then the parole process, how we schedule hearings. And then after the hearings are over and somebody's paroled, it still takes, you know, another couple months to get them out. So our system sometimes moves at a leisurely pace, and that costs money. And in these financial times, we can't afford to do that.
Well, it's interesting that the problems seem to be at both ends, the entrance and the exit from the prison system.
Yes, that's accurate. And what's going on
and
inside.
What's going on. And we'll,
so
talk,
all three,
we'll
yeah.
talk about all three. About a third of inmates in Pennsylvania serving time for nonviolent crimes. Is that about right?
Yes. Yes, that's in the ballpark.
And are we talking what, drugs and alcohol-related crimes?
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Drunk driving.
Drunk driving's a piece of it. Property crimes, and unoccupied buildings, even retail theft. You know, 10% of our population are misdemeanor offenders. So we have 5,000 inmates in our system for misdemeanors only.
Wow.
Which is kind of shocking for a system that you alluded to the cost, $90 a day.
That's what it costs to keep someone incarcerated.
Yep.
Should we, though, if we're thinking about not just saving money, but also making a more efficient and a better prison system, should we focus largely then on violent offenders and then try to figure out what to do with some of these nonviolent offenders?
Yes. And keep in mind, that's the way the system was set up. Our system was designed for serious offenders. We're very good at managing those folks. But what it's evolved to, and you know how, you know, when people talk to me about corrections policy, I kind of laugh because we don't. Corrections policy implies that there's been conscious decisions made at how we're going to administer justice. That's not the case. And that's also the primary reason why Governor Corbett started this initiative with justice reinvestment by applying for a grant to the feds. And also the coalition that you referred to earlier with the Commonwealth Foundation, the ACLU, the Leader family, because he felt like it was important that we got all the stakeholders around the table and made some conscious decisions at how we administer justice in Pennsylvania, how we want our correction system to work, with the measurable not being, the first measurable is not the money. The first measurable is the outcomes. 44% of the offenders who get out come back. And what that really means is
meaning
that
they recommit crimes,
yes,
or get rearrested.
Right. So they recidivate. Or they're violated on parole. Either way, they're getting out and they're screwing up our communities. And so we need to do a better job of how, when the offenders come in, but we also need to do a better job of discerning who comes in the front door. So the governor set the kind of the outside coalition, allowed me to work with these folks to really get that outside perspective and the common citizen kind of perspective, because we're kind of in the beltway. And so having groups like, you know, the ACLU and Commonwealth Foundation and the Leader family all create an alliance to say, yes, we need to have a better correction system is essential.
But don't you need to get the legislature to sign on this? I mean, it's the legislature who writes the laws, and these are the laws that put people behind bars.
Yeah, that's a piece of it. And through the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, all four caucuses were represented on there. So I would say that this is very unlike most processes, and especially as it relates to legislative things, when you have all four caucuses, all different chambers, including the courts and human services and all those folks sitting around the table discussing how we want our correction system to work. Everybody, we've talked about the correction system being a problem in Pennsylvania for as long as I can recall. We have an opportunity here in working with the legislators and partnering with the legislators to pass meaningful, but I would call it pretty surgical legislation that really focuses on the lowest end of our system, really focuses on the nonviolent offenders, the short-term offenders. I mean, to give you a for instance, if an offender, we call them short mins, right? Short minimums. So they come in with less than a year to serve to the department. They serve on average 200 days over their minimum because we're inefficient. We're not able to process them.
I mean, literally, you mean process them and process them out of the system?
Yes, and deliver programming if that's necessary. So you have somebody who, if they were sentenced locally for a six-month sentence to a county, in most cases, they're going to get out at 6 months. If they come to us with a six-month sentence, they're going to get out in a year. So that's 6 months extra they've spent, not because they're a risk to the community, but because that's how our system works. So really focusing on those, the lowest end of our system makes a lot of sense. And it will allow us to focus on what we're good at, the upper end of our system.
Well, and you're talking about millions of dollars spent keeping these mins, these short mins, behind bars.
Yes. Yes. And again, and one of the things the governor was clear about from day one, if it cost us $2 billion to ensure that we're ensuring the public safety through corrections, we're going to spend whatever it needs to, but it doesn't. We're not getting the outcomes. And it's one of the reasons why we started this way back right after the governor got elected. This is one of the first things he did, put this group together.
Well, let me focus then on those people that they've essentially served their time, but they're not released from prison yet. What would not just smooth that process, but also get them the services that they needed? How do you invest in that end of the system?
Well, there's a couple things. One of them is delivering programs in a timely manner. Having a bunch of lower-end individuals come in with programming needs and they have a short time, we assign programs based on how much time people have left. So it adds waiting time to that by having so many of those folks come in. A third of our commitments have less than a year to serve. So delivering programs in a timely manner, by having less of those folks come into us, it'll just naturally reduce the waiting time for the programs.
And when you're talking about programs, what, drug and alcohol?
Drug and alcohol programs, criminal thinking programs. I mean, criminals think differently. When an event happens, they process the event differently and react accordingly. So it really is kind of reprogramming or re-educating. Also education. Half our inmates come in without a high school diploma. And if you look at what the goal of our system is, which is to take these folks who are big tax burdens and turn them into taxpayers on the back end, education is a key piece of that. So by reducing the amount of short-term offenders we have, coupled with we've taken three of our facilities and we're switching them over to short men facilities. So we'll focus our resources there and also focus the parole board's resources so they can get hearings in a timely manner. That should significantly help to process those folks in.
Let me talk about prison construction. And a couple of weeks ago, as I said in my billboard, I was interviewing the governor outside. There were protesters, and some of those protesters were talking about a moratorium on prison construction. What's your response to that?
I think we started one last year, is my response. We stopped the construction of a prison in Fayette County, German Township. There was a prison being built in Benner Township that was well underway and almost, so we couldn't stop that one. And then the one I think they're probably likely referring to is the prison being built at Greaterford.
Right. And outside of Philly.
Yes. But when you talk about moratorium, I think you're talking about expansion. And that is specifically being designed to replace Old Greaterford. Old Greaterford is a very inefficient building. In the new design, we have 900 more design beds in the design, and we can operate with the same number of staff. But also, when you look at part of the solution, it's reentry, right? And a third of our inmates come from the greater Philadelphia area, I'll call it. Females in particular. A third of our females come from Philadelphia. The closest female prison we have to Philadelphia is up above Williamsport. And when you talk about females incarcerated in the state or getting out, generally you're talking about a custodial parent or at least a parent. So that reentry for those folks is essential. So as part of this redesign and replacement of Greaterford, we're putting a female housing unit down there specifically to aid in the transition of female inmates back to the Philadelphia system. That's the long-term answer. It's not just focusing on who we have today, but but the reentry and also the children of incarcerated parents, which is a huge issue.
Mm. But is your goal to literally reduce the number of inmates in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. That's been our goal from day one.
And do you have a number in mind? If they're 51,000 today?
No, I mean, we're certainly shooting for, I would hope, somewhere in the 10% range. But, you know, if it's 100 a month, we're happy, you know, assuming we're making good decisions on who we're reducing it by. And I feel confident this process leads to a situation where we are making good choices on it.
I'm thinking about that front end and the fact that, as you said, a number of people being put behind bars are there because of drugs or alcohol. Is there a treatment approach to those offenders that would better serve the community?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the key things that a lot of counties are doing are specialty courts, right? Drug courts, mental health courts. Some call them treatment courts. Some have DUI courts. A new growing area is veterans courts. 7% of our population are veterans. So these specialized courts generally take a treatment approach with some enforcement oversight, generally by the local probation and parole. Very successful. In counties that do mental health court, for instance, they send less mentally ill offenders to the Department of Corrections percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia included in that. So the research has been kind of across the board that they have an impact. And why they have an impact is because, one, you're getting to the root cause of the crime. And that's what we need to do as a system. We need to make a conscious decision how we're going to respond to the root cause of the crime. And if it's a drug addiction, if it's an alcohol addiction, if it's a mental health issue, if it's PTSD for veterans, if we don't address that root cause, you can send them to us for 5 years, 10 years. If we don't address it, when they get back out, it's not going away.
Are these crimes of quote-unquote bad choices, that these are people that are just did something stupid or something that just was bad for them?
Yeah, and sometimes it was a bunch of things. I mean, by the time you get to the State Department of Corrections, make no bones about it. You didn't just make one bad choice and steal one Snickers bar, okay? You've made several bad choices, but that's not inconsistent with someone who's living a life of addiction and doing a bunch of retail theft, a bunch of theft of unoccupied buildings. So not generally what we associate with violent crimes, mm-hmm. but to feed the addiction. And when they add up and you get 4, 5, 6, 7, then that is aggregated together and they come to us. And if we can take a treatment approach to a treatment issue, it makes a lot more sense. And if we can deliver it in a community where we can keep their support systems intact, because that's an essential piece getting out, from faith groups to family, but also, when you talk about a family member going to the State Department of Corrections, the drain that puts on the system for the rest of the family. To the extent that we can keep folks closer to home and engage with that oversight, that it, you know, to give people an opportunity. Some people aren't going to avail themselves of it, then send them to us.
And that's John Wetzel. He's Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. He's had the job a bit more than a year, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. We're talking about plans to reform the system of corrections in the state of Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Mark Bergstrom waiting in the wings, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the American Philosophical Society Museum, celebrating a rare astronomical event, the transit of Venus, with an exhibition of 18th century telescopes and clocks. Also, an original theater piece by Aaron Cromie, a talk by author Andrea Wolf, and a weekend of family-friendly, hands-on activities with Derek Pitts, June 1st through 10th. To register, apsmuseum.org.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music, Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964. They are currently performing research to develop improved treatments for people who experience periods of depression followed by uncontrollable shifts between highly energized and depressive moods. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. A number of people in Pennsylvania are calling for prison reform, and among those people is our guest, John Wetzel, Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, and joining us to talk about what he thinks should be done to reform the prison system in the state of Pennsylvania. Also with us now is Mark Bergstrom, and he's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. He's been listening in, and Mark Bergstrom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me put a couple of questions to you that I talked with the secretary about. One is sentencing reform. Does it make sense to at least begin to think about reducing the number of people in Pennsylvania prisons?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's more about trying to figure out who really needs to be in state prison and who might be better served in a different way, either through community-based alternatives or county jails, other means of dealing with offenders.
Picking up on that, looking, I guess, at the front end of the system, how do you think it should be reformed?
Well, we started with some reforms in 2008 that really tried to have judges start thinking more about risk of reoffense than just holding an offender accountable. We want to hold offenders accountable, but one of the key differences in deciding when you need to use state prison and when you don't is this person at risk of reoffense and at risk of a violent reoffense, because those are certainly the people that should be sent to the secretary and to the Department of Corrections. But if it's a person that could benefit better from treatment or some type of custody at the local level, that might be a better choice.
And is there enough treatment for those people?
Well, I think that's one of the benefits of this process that's underway right now, really trying to right-size the system, trying to identify where there might be gaps in resources and trying to address those, and to some degree reinvesting any savings from the Department of Corrections into the front end so that you do have courts and others have those options available.
Well, let me turn back to you, John Wetzel. Thinking about the almost $2 billion that is spent in Pennsylvania, can some of that money be moved to this front end that we've been talking about?
Yeah, that's the design of this process, is that as we depopulate the back end, or the high-rent district, as I like to refer to it, we can take some of that money and reinvest it in the front end. And when I say the front end, local law enforcement, first and foremost, because we know that good law enforcement intercedes in individuals' life of crime earlier on. So local law enforcement, local probation and parole, who have a huge task, but also local jails. And to try to alleviate some of that monetary pressure in the decision-making process, so we can just put people in the system where we're going to get the best outcome. Mm-hmm. And everybody across the board agrees that what we want out of our system when somebody comes criminally involved is that when they get out the back end, they're less likely to commit another crime. But Mark also referred to kind of risk-based sentencing approach, and that was part of the 2008 reform package that went through. Although the risk assessment piece of it in particular has yet to be fully funded to get that risk assessment tool built, and Mark's operation has been tasked to do that. So hopefully at some point we can tie some of these savings to that, because that tool in particular gives judges, as Mark talked about, the ability to make a good decision based on data. And our system, as sad as this may seem, we don't always make decisions based on good data.
Well, Mark Bergstrom, let me turn back to you, and this is not the first time prison reform has been discussed in Pennsylvania. Do you think, though, that something has changed, that there is true interest in reforming the system and making it more efficient, more cost-effective?
Well, yeah, I think some of the efforts the Secretary talked about, both sort of the internal efforts within government through the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, trying to get all the players together and sort of on the same page, engaging the legislature, the administration, and the courts. But I think equally important is sort of the external effort that I don't think was in place before. And the Secretary talked about the efforts of the Leader family and the Commonwealth Foundation and others. So I think this is the first time that you have this really, I think, well-planned effort to coordinate these interests and trying to build community support as well as sort of the internals in government. So I think that's great. And I think the Secretary's point just a moment ago about some of the other related things, not as sexy, but some of the things like the quality of the information, you know, reducing inefficiencies or improving coordination and improving transparency. All of those are things we talked about in 2008 and again in 2010, but I think this is yet another effort to really engage in those areas.
And Mark, what do you think about Greater Ferd and essentially replacing the old prison with a new one, and also having a wing for women offenders that are closer to Philadelphia? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, I think it makes a lot of sense, because we've talked for a long time about the inefficiencies of some of the old institutions and the safety concerns in the old institutions. So I think there's a great argument to be made, both in cost savings and in safety, to replace these old institutions. On the other hand, reentry has been sort of the buzzword for the last decade, and this is a real, I think, important reentry effort, especially for female offenders, which are a growing part of the population, and in an area like Philadelphia, which is an important area of the state.
And let me go back to you, John Wetzel. Looking about this at this reentry, what do prisoners, and let's include their families, what do they need to make this a successful reentry back into the community?
Well, it starts with they need us to make sure that they have an opportunity to address the root cause of the crime when they're with us, all right? And it also starts with making good decisions to put them at the proper level. But then there's some realities. You got to pay bills, right? So hopefully we've been able to increase marketable job skills and those kinds of things. But also prepare them for rejection. And when you talk to offenders, that's the thing that hits them in the face, first of all. I mean, to even get, for anyone to get a job right now, In this economy is a challenge.
Indeed.
Check the box for felon, and it is much more difficult. But we know employment is an important piece of it. But another important piece of it is that social supports, positive social supports. And again, I look to the faith communities in particular that have the infrastructure that people can really benefit from. And if you broaden that out to kind of spiritual-based programs that includes the AA and NA and those kinds of things, it's very important that offenders coming out have a positive individual who they can identify as a mentor. Mm-hmm. There's research out there, especially with technical parole violators, that really point to that. So to the extent that we can get people closer to home, we have a volunteer pool here in Philadelphia with several different faith communities who we've talked about who are ready to greet these ladies coming back to the community. That's an important piece of the reentry. There's some realities as far as working and the reintegration in the family, and you know, mom's been gone for 3 years and now she's coming back into this household and we've kind of adjusted without her, and all those real things that we have to deal with. But employment and drug and alcohol or whatever kind of counseling and the faith community, I think, are really the three key pieces.
Well, that makes total sense. I think the challenge is making that work and actually not just having the services, but having good services and making sure that people access those services.
Connection,
on top of the
right.
Connections.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's a complicated world out there.
It is, but I'll tell you, having them 20 miles from Philly as opposed to 150 miles from Philly, one would think that we have a better opportunity to make some strong connections.
Mark, you want to add anything to that?
No, I just think that's a great way to identify what you need to do within the institution and then how you translate that or move that back into the community, that you can't just open the door, let someone out, and expect great things. You have to work with them in the institution, and then you have to really help to sort of shepherd that transition back to the community and make sure there's, you know, they have viable skills and other things like that that will enhance their chances of success.
Let me put something back to you, John Wetzel, then we'll get to our callers. And I'm just thinking about prevention. We've been talking about parole and probation, but the importance of prevention. You go to some neighborhoods and there are no playgrounds. There aren't places where kids can hang out and not get in trouble. Schools are struggling. Families are, you know, in chaos. This can all lead to, you know, a life of crime. Not in all cases, of course. But
I mean, generally, how it works, any system, education system, human service system, generally failures in those systems lead to our system and we don't have no vacancy signs. So, you know, we're a system who doesn't turn anybody away. Right. So to your point, absolutely, the answer lies well before the criminal justice system. But for us to put together a successful effort, we have to focus on what we can control and what we have the ability to impact. And then hopefully the impact can grow from there.
And that's John Wetzel. He's secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, a job he's had since May 2011, a bit more than a year. Also with us is Mark Bergstrom, and he's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. We are talking about what can be done to reform Pennsylvania's correction system. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think can be done to improve the system? Let's see what Dan from West Philadelphia has to say. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me and for having this really important conversation.
Thanks.
You talked so far about justice reinvestment as being a process to save money and also to help the children of incarcerated parents and the communities that they come from. But it seems like there's a sort of contradiction of, that the Justice Reinvestment Working Group didn't include any formerly incarcerated people, didn't include anyone from Philadelphia, or any family members of incarcerated people on the panel. So it seems to me that the working group can't really serve populations that were excluded from the process, especially when the state is spending $685 million to build new and bigger prisons.
Dan, let me give the secretary a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, that's not completely accurate. The structure of the Justice Reinvestment was this kind of policy reporting out group. But most of the work actually got done in focus groups. And there was a focus group specifically for the family and formerly incarcerated individuals. And the Prison Society from Pennsylvania coordinated that group. And the Justice Reinvestment folks gave them as equal access as every other focus group, to include the victims focus groups and others. And also, former offenders and family members of offenders were represented on the Commonwealth Foundation leader family effort, so kind of the other parallel effort. And as far as no representation from Philadelphia, that's not accurate either. Greg Rowe from the District Attorney's Association, who's based out of Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, was represented, as was Judge Smith Ribner, who's a retired judge, and she was actually a judicial rep, and she's from Philadelphia.
Anything you want to add to that, Mark?
No, just seconding that although the membership of the Justice Reinvestment work groups might not have included ex-offenders, they were certainly represented in the efforts underway, the interviews and so forth.
Dan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark, let me ask you something that I was putting to John Wetzel about the legislature. And clearly, when you look over the last couple of decades, you see these get tough with crime laws. Pennsylvania is not the only state that has instituted those laws. Is it time to rethink them, do you think?
Well, I think it's it's always helpful to sort of look back at things, make sure that the data that we collect, that the information we know, sort of matches what the rhetoric might have been. But I think the focus on risk of reoffense adds just a new dimension that allows sort of a rethinking of that, where we can look at those that are low risk of any kind of reoffense and maybe think about them differently in terms of whether mandatories or harsh sentencing need to apply, because maybe community-based alternatives do make a lot more sense in both terms of outcomes but also in terms of resources. And at the same time, when you're looking at risk, you look at someone who's at high risk of a violent reoffense, and you think about how better to use the Department of Corrections to manage those kind of cases, because those are the real threats to public safety. So I think this additional layer of information, this additional information for judges, can help to make better decisions that don't necessarily undermine what was done in the past, but maybe refine it a bit.
And do we have data to know who is at risk for reoffense?
Well, yeah, and that's what the secretary mentioned before. The commission has been mandated to work on that and to, in effect, copy some of the efforts done in other states that have been successful in sort of sorting out based on risk offenders. Just because of the economy, we haven't had the resources to do that, but we're working away at it, and hopefully we'll be able to get something like that in place to assist judges.
Let me get looks like Charles from Willow Grove to join us on Radio Times. And Charles, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Marty, this is a wonderful show,
thank
everybody for participating. My question relates to the last roughly 20 years when mandatory sentencing has come in, and the district attorney seems to be controlling the sentencing and not the judges. And this is causing a explosion in the entire country of population of the up to 2.4 million incarcerated people in the country, which is a disgrace. And it's costing every state an unbelievable amount of money. And building more prisons doesn't seem to be the answer. And I'd like a comment, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. John Wetzel, go ahead.
Well, I agree. Building more prisons isn't the answer, which is why we stopped construction of a prison. That's one of the first things the governor did. I agree with that point. But I got to tell you, through this Justice Reinvestment Initiative, the district attorneys have been sitting at the table with us, at both the Commonwealth Foundation and Leader Family Effort and the Justice Reinvestment, and they want the same outcome, too. And I think there's some realization that we're not always making the best choices as to our response for crime. And they've been at the table, and they're an important voice. And also, they play an important role. You know, there needs to be a limiting factor. We need to make sure we're making decisions that are going to have a positive impact on public safety, and they play an important role in that. As far as the mandatories, I'll turn it over to Mark,
who say,
probably knows more about
ahead.
That. Than
Mark, that's totally in your wheelhouse. Go ahead.
Sure. The commission recently did a study of mandatories, and I agree with the gentleman's point that over the past 20 years, mandatories have played a bigger role. I think the concern is more about mandatories related to drugs and what might be viewed as nonviolent offenses versus violent offenses. I think absent mandatories, judges would probably be making decisions similar to DAs related to longer sentences for violent offenders. I think when you get to drug offenses, that's where there's a concern because there are cases where a judge may want to try treatment or some other kind of alternative, and the mandatory, in effect, takes that choice away from the judge. But I agree with the Secretary that the DAs have been an active partner in working through a lot of these alternatives or this discussion of justice reinvestment, and I think there's you know, areas to be identified where maybe the mandatories could be loosened or weakened a bit.
And Mark, we have to say goodbye to you, but I'm just curious, any final thoughts before we say goodbye, and then we'll continue with the Secretary?
I guess just to echo something the Secretary talked about and you started with, which was these short min sentences. I think that really is a concern when you're using state prison facilities, very expensive facilities, for people with very short minimum sentences. I think that gets to the issue of risk and needs, and perhaps those are that's the right target to say, are these individuals we could do something different with other than state incarceration?
Well, Mark Bergstrom, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome. And
Bye-bye.
He's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, a job he's had since 1998. John Wetzel staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. He began his corrections career in 1989 as an officer at the Lebanon County Correctional Facility. He then transferred to the Berks County Prison. He was a warden of the Franklin County Jail. And for a while, he sat on the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Savoy Company presents Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado at the DuPont Theater and Longwood Gardens. Under the stage direction of Ted Christopher and musical direction of Todd Florin, this mystical tale of wit is a musical delight. DuPont Theater performances on June 1st and 2nd, and at Longwood Gardens on June 29th and 30th. More information and tickets online at savoy.org or at 215-735-7161.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
ChristianaCare Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at ChristianaCare.org/heartleaders.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a number of things, including the fact that the prison population in Pennsylvania has increased dramatically in the last three decades, from 7,000 inmates in 1980 to more than 50,000 today. And the cost to incarcerate so many people in Pennsylvania is close to $2 billion. And again, the Pennsylvania Corrections Secretary John Wetzel is our guest. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One of the, I guess I would call it a critiques about prison construction is that it provides employment. They're oftentimes built in rural parts of the state. They could use the jobs, whether the construction jobs or the jobs within the facility. Does that not compute anymore? Are those days over?
It doesn't compute to the Corbett administration, I can tell you that. And when we stopped construction of the German Township prison, one of the first things the governor said in his budget address was that we don't view prison construction as economic development. That's not going to be the vehicle that we develop communities. The challenging part that creates when you go to rural kind of western communities is that we have a 10,000 inmate. We get 10,000 more inmates from the east than we do from the west, and we have 10,000 less beds in the east than we do in the west. And if we're going to be serious about reentry and really setting people up for success when they get out, getting them closer to home as they get closer to getting out is an essential piece of that. And frankly, it's a challenge to do that.
I'm thinking, though, that within a prison, there's much more control of the inmate population, clearly. Once people are released into the community, yes, you have the parole system, but you don't have the same kind of control over somebody's life. Do we need to think either more parole officers or more services that can be provided, more oversight in the community itself?
Yeah, and I think the this year's budget request for the department has is flat. And what that means is really our cost to carry, our rollover cost, about $100 million. So it's really a $100 million cut. Mm-hmm. A piece of that was allocated to parole, to increase the amount of parole staff for that specific reason, because we think we'll get a better outcome by having more folks out in the community, but we need them under supervision in a safe environment. The other thing you refer to is kind of easing people back to make that transition. And we have a community correction system with 14 state-run community correction centers or halfway houses, another 40 contract. And that's an area we're looking at specifically for technical parole violators, people who've not committed a new crime but have not followed the rules and regulations of probation and parole. Because of that, they come back to us on average 9 months. Mm. And we're looking specifically at that group to keep them in the community correction system, which keeps them in their community. And if they're employed, it keeps them in that job and gives them the ability to do those kinds of things. So we don't have to rebuild that whole infrastructure you just referred to with the transition. We can keep them closer to the community and keep those community ties stronger.
How many people in the Pennsylvania prison system are senior citizens?
That's a growing number. I don't have the percentage, but you know, in a state that life means life, we see our population getting older. And actually, we have a nursing home prison, Laurel Highlands. It's kind of shocking to walk through, frankly.
And you see people that will never get out and are, 70, 80 years old?
Yeah, and some just, you know, incapacitated. But again, life means life. And the group that you're talking about primarily at that nursing home are sex offenders who are doing a long time and lifers. And you know, that's the cost of doing business.
Let me get Ed from, looks like Wilkes-Barre, to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Quick yes or no. Will the Corbett administration be cutting back on expenditures for prisoner health care? And will the Corbett administration be increasing the cost of collect calls to that prisoners have to make to friends and family and loved ones, through that sort of kickback commission scheme that Verizon has with the Department of Corrections.
And Ed, I'm just curious why you ask.
Well, both of those affect the quality of life of prisoners and their families, which is, has a key role in recidivism and successive, quote, corrections. I don't know if a lot of correcting is going on, but that's one thing that could be used.
Fair enough. Let me give the Secretary a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Well, I would agree that not enough corrections is going on, so I'll agree with that point. As far as prisoner health care, yes, actually, we just rebid health care, and the cost came in lower. It hasn't been bid in 8 years. Going through that process, we're going to save a couple million dollars through that. So we're going to be spending less and getting the same level of care, which is important because if you have a poor level of care, you get lawsuits beyond the human cost. The second piece, inmate phone calls, again, we agree. As a matter of fact, one of the things we did last year is we negotiated with the provider of the inmates call collect or debit calling. And so if they use the debit calling, they actually get a reduced price. So the price now is cheaper than it was 2 years ago. So we agree that it's important to keep those family units together. Now, when you refer to kickbacks and that kind of stuff, I obviously have to take issue with that. We do make a commission, but that commission is reinvested back into the inmates. It pays for programs. It pays for IDs for all inmates. Every inmate who's being released, again, under the Corbett administration, we're taking some of the profits from the phone calls and from the commissary and buying state-issued IDs for all offenders getting out. Because not having an ID when you get out is a huge impediment to even get cough medicine, you know, at the grocery store. So that's, you know, when you refer to it as a kickback, that's not a kickback. That's an investment in the inmates, and they pay for a service just like you and I pay. I don't like how high my cell phone bill is, especially with four daughters.
Ed, thank you for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what it looks like. Pat from Eagleville has to say. And Pat, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
My mind boggles that a former district attorney would change and extend the law, Castle Domain, which
the Castle Doctrine.
You can use, I beg your pardon?
It's called the Castle Doctrine.
Doctrine. I'm sorry. Corrected. Anyhow, you can use any means to protect a family when they're threatened in your home. Now that extends to the public. Example, the Ron Paul had a tent in Occupy Wall Street in Philadelphia, and his representative walked around armed, and there was nothing that our police could do about it. It means that you could walk into a park or a library or any public place armed if you feel that somebody else is threatening you.
Well, Pat, you're, I think, a little bit mixing apples and oranges, but nonetheless, let me give our guest, John Wetzel, a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, that's a difficult one because I'm certainly not a district attorney, but as I understand the Castle Doctrine, I don't know that it expanded someone's ability to carry a weapon. It deals specifically with someone who's threatened and in what area they're feeling threatened. But again, I don't know that's really germane to this conversation.
Well, fair enough. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Something you mentioned earlier about someone getting out of prison, how hard it is to get a job these days. And if you check that little box that says that you're a felon, how much harder it is. Is there something you want to say to prospective employers? Obviously, you can't speak for everyone that's been released from prison. But if people are suspicious and they're concerned about hiring someone who has served time, is there a response to that?
Yeah, I think that when you hear a 56% or 44% recidivism rate, that means 56% don't recidivate. Right. And a large portion of them get jobs and are very successful. We have a very good vocational training program. And actually, again, under this governor, we partner with labor and industry. And they actually look at every vocational program we offer and if it's an area where an offender can get a job when they get out. So we're really trying to align the marketable job skills of our offenders with the jobs that are available in the community. But through our community correction system in particular, we use a lot of day labor places. And what the experience of a lot of folks have found is that our guys, when they go to day labor, work their butts off. They're very motivated. They're motivated to come to work. They're going to come to work sober. They're going to come to work on time. And through day labor, the employers get to learn who this person is, not just the felon, mm-hmm. right? And get some experience. And we get a lot of people employed through that mechanism. So I think it's a good opportunity to take a chance on some folks who may have some vocational skills that you don't see from John Q. Public, and they've made the most out of this opportunity. I think we have the greatest justice system in the world, and certainly it's not perfect. But if someone who comes in the system and gets motivated for whatever reason and really wants to make the most out of it, they have an opportunity to really turn their life around. And there's former offenders all throughout the country, but here in Philadelphia in particular, who've done just that and who are now business owners and successful in all kinds of domains, all the way up to, you know, teaching at universities. So I think it's an opportunity to find the right ones. And again, you don't paint with a broad brush.
Of course.
But take an opportunity. Take a chance on some folks.
You've worked in jails, and now you're the Secretary of Corrections. Should there be more coordination between jails and the larger system?
Yes. And you know, we're as strong as the front end of the system. We talked about law enforcement. Local jails are the same way. When local jails do a good job, less people come to us. When they address those needs, when they put people at the right level of continuum, we have less people coming to us. We've had a great partnership over the past year and a half with the local jails. We've provided several local jails with acting wardens when their wardens retired. We've provided some kind of technical assistance. So we are really committed. Also, we've begun contracting with local jails for their work release programs for offenders getting out. Especially in some of our rural counties, we don't have community correction centers in those areas because we don't have the numbers going back to those counties. Mm-hmm. But county jail work release programs have, you talk about employment, they have relationships with employers who are comfortable with the inmates that they get sent from the work release program. They have resources for housing, which is another huge impediment for people staying out. So if we can plug them back in those local systems, pay the locals what we'd pay somebody else for the same service, we're reinvesting money back into that county and ensuring a better outcome for the offenders. So we're all in as far as partnerships with local government.
How did you get interested in law, I guess, law enforcement slash the justice system slash corrections?
Yeah, I think I'm like a lot of people where you just kind of accidentally end up.
Is that right? In,
yeah, I was a part-time applied. My brother was a correctional officer at Lebanon County. I was a college student at Bloomsburg University looking for a part-time job. And, you know, as they say in Seinfeld, yada, 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 you know, 23 years later, here you are.
Here you are. Does it help to be, we're on the radio here, but does it help to be a big guy in your line of work? You're a big guy.
Well, you know, since I've been a big guy all my life, I couldn't tell you what the other end of it
what it's like
is,
to be
but
a
it's worked
guy.
Out pretty well for me.
Have you, I'm looking at some information that we got from Decarcerate Pennsylvania, and as I said, they were protesting outside when I interviewed the governor. You were on the inside with the audience there. But reading their material and, frankly, talking to you and reading about you, it sounds like you might have some things in common with this group.
I think generally we do. I mean, generally we all want, again, we all want the same thing out of our correction system. We want the right number, the right people sent to us, and people who get out, we don't want them to come back. So I think there's a lot of common ground. There's things we're always going to disagree on, that's fine. But we can always have a conversation. And I know Decarcerate reached out to my office, and we're going to be meeting in the near future and look forward to it.
Yeah. This is we've done whole hours on this, but does it make sense, you think, to at least think about decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana, something like that? I mean, I'm just thinking about how much people who engage in that get caught up in the system.
Yeah, you know, I don't see a whole lot of people in the Department of Corrections for having a joint on them. I really don't. So I know there's always a lot of talk about that kind of stuff. We've really focused on things that we can that are achievable and transformative, because we want it achieved right now. We don't want this package coming out of Justice Reinvestment to wait till the fall or to next spring. We want it done right now with the budget, because how things work is that in corrections is that when you make improvements in the system legislatively, it takes a year to a year and a half to have any impact. So we're not talking about this year's budget necessarily, next year's budget.
But, and so this is a salvo, I guess, to the legislature, right? To look at this budget and look at the way that the spending is being, or the money is being spent.
Yeah, and I think that the governor did that at the last Justice Reinvestment meeting when he said this is a policy package that improves public safety and saves spending, and we're ready to work with the legislators to get it passed right now.
Let me see what Rich from Lansdale has to say. Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Rich.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd just like to know what the Corrections Department is doing with things like GPS technology and, you know, micro recording technology to be able to tag prisoners rather than incarcerate them, particularly for nonviolence?
It's a good question, Rich. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Secretary.
Yeah, in our policy options coming out of the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, we're really looking to expand the use of electronic monitoring and GPS, which, frankly, the Commonwealth is behind on as far as the technology. A lot of county systems are using this technology very well. You have to have realistic expectations at what you get out of it. GPS monitoring doesn't mean that the second somebody crosses the street the wrong way, you know, the cops are going to swoop in and grab them. You have to have realistic expectations. But we certainly have an opportunity to expand the use of that. And to the caller's point, I think he's right on time. And we're working with our partners over at the Board of Probation and Parole, really looking to expand that, especially with technical parole violators and folks just getting out. It's a good opportunity for us.
We're almost out of time here. You sat on the Pardons Board for a while. Is it time to rethink the Pardons Board as well?
I found my experience in the Pardons Board to be a good process. I know there was some legislation a couple years ago that passed that switched some offenses to expungement versus going through the whole 3-year process to get a pardon. I think to that end, that made a lot of sense, and perhaps there's some low-end stuff we can look to add into that. But the pardon is an extraordinary remedy by the governor of Pennsylvania, and it should be a difficult process.
Well, John Wetzel, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's the Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections under Governor Tom Corbett. In fact, was appointed about a year ago. We also spoke with Mark Bergstrom. He's the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. We obviously took calls as well, and you can check us out on Facebook. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.